Okay, well, good morning. Thanks, Travis and band, for leading us in worship. Before we jump into our sermon, I'm going to give us just a couple quick announcements. Just reminders, this coming Saturday, June 7th, is Service Saturday, so this is something we do every other month, the even months of the year. On the first Saturday of those months, we try to serve people in our church community right here and sometimes outside of our church community, and just those that are having some needs right now, we come together and divvy up some groups of people and try to meet those needs. So if you'd like to join us in that, meet actually in the gym at 8 a.m. next Saturday. It's going to be a great time. And then secondly, just a reminder, our Alpha Center baby bottle campaign is going on right now, and so you'll see a little booth out there in the lobby. And this is just an opportunity to it's an annual thing that we do, really between Mother's Day and Father's Day. We raise some money to help with what the Alpha Center, Crisis Pregnancy Center, does. And so the idea is just to take one of those baby bottles, fill it up with a bunch of loose change, and then bring it back next week. And so we've just got a couple weeks left of that, but remember that that's happening. Okay, you know, sometimes we describe a person to somebody else, somebody that might not know that person or not know them that well. Okay, we tell that person what this other person is like. Hopefully it's positive. Okay, if it's negative, that's called gossip and that's bad. Don't do that. But we describe people positively to other people that don't know them. And so we describe their qualities. We describe what they're like. We say, he's the kind of person who might do this, or she's the kind of person who blank. And we describe these people. So for example, I could describe my wife to you. And I could say, she's the kind of person who fills up her phone with pictures of flowers. Okay, so that's what she does. And so we go on a walk, and she sees a flower, and she's there, and she's taken a close-up picture of this flower, and her phone and the hard drive on our computer is full of flower pictures. And we go for a walk as a family, and sometimes we look around and say, where's mom? And she, because she's back there taking a picture of a flower. Why does she do that? Because she is intrigued, and she just experiences this sense of awe and wonder when she sees that natural beauty. And she's pretty excited by this year's VBS theme, which is magnified, because it's all about discovering the intricacies of what God has designed in this world. And so that's what she does. And so she's the kind of person who takes lots of pictures of flowers. And I could say, I love that about her. Okay, so she's that kind of person, which I love about her. I love that she leads our family into experiencing that sense of wonder and awe that the rest of us might not naturally experience otherwise. So I love that about her. Now, when we come here on Sunday mornings, a lot of our goal is to be able to say something like that about God. We're trying to say that about God. A.W. Tozer has a famous quote. He says, what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. I think that's true. Okay, what we think about God is vitally important. The kinds of qualities and attributes that come into mind when somebody asks us, what is God like, that determines everything. And so we want to be able to have answers to these questions. What is God like? What kind of person is God? What are the kinds of things that God does? If we were to describe God to somebody else, how would we describe him? God's the kind of person who does such and such. Well, very generally, or in a basic way, if I was to answer that question, what is God like? Well, I would give the basic Sunday school answer, because it's the right one. What is God like? Jesus. If kids are with us, you know, this morning, and they know that the answer to every question in Sunday school is Jesus. And this, it's the answer to this question too. What is God like? Jesus. Hebrews 1:3 Jesus is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. And he upholds the universe by the word of his power. In Colossians 1:19, for in him, Jesus, all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. We want to get to know God, but God revealed himself in Jesus. And so when we read about Jesus, we are seeing God. We're seeing what God would do. We're seeing how God interacts with people. We're seeing the attributes of God that stand out as we observe what Jesus did. God does not remain abstract, unknowable. Instead, he becomes very tangible. And we see him in Jesus, and we say, that's what God is like. And then once we see what he's like, we are compelled to love what he's like. You know, the high school youth this past semester, we spent a few weeks on this topic of evangelism, talking about sharing about Jesus with other people, both believers and unbelievers. And we went through this material from a teacher named Glenn Scrivener. And he talked through different concepts about evangelism, but he tried to plant one phrase in our heads that was really important. This was kind of a lot of the foundation of evangelism, and it was this phrase, that's what I love about Jesus. And he encouraged us to be able to say that, like to say something about Jesus and say, that's what I love about Jesus. That's really the foundation of evangelism. Seeing Jesus clearly, and then just genuinely loving who he is, and then speaking it. That's what I love about Jesus. Now, as Travis shared earlier, the kids are in here this summer and this week for our sermon, and you will have an opportunity to answer a question later in the morning. And win a prize this morning. It's an Action Bible, and so you're going to answer a question. And so I'll just give you the hint, or really the question. Kids, be able to say this about something specific. That's what I love about Jesus. And so I'm actually going to give you I'm going to let you have lots of different answers to that. I'll give you a few ideas as we go along here, but that's what you're going to be answering later. But that's what we're going for this morning and really throughout this series, this Encounter Jesus series, as we go through a bunch of stories about Jesus from the Gospels. We're trying to see what he's like and then be able to say that. That's what I love about Jesus. And so with that in mind, we're going to read today's passage, and it is Mark 2:13-20. Why don't you open up to that if you're using a house Bible that's in front of you in the pew. It's on page 837. All right, verse 13. He went out again beside the sea, and all the crowd was coming to him, and he was teaching them. And as he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax booth. And he said to him, follow me. And he rose and followed him. And as he reclined at table in his house, many tax collectors and sinners were reclining with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. And the scribes of the Pharisees, when they saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, said to his disciples, why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? And when Jesus heard it, he said to them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. Just a really remarkable passage here. And shows us who Jesus is, shows us who God is in a tangible way. So with that passage in mind, we're going to answer that question or fill in that statement in a few different ways. And I'm going to give you three different things that I love about Jesus as we see in this passage. So the first one, what I love about Jesus is that he keeps company with the despised. Of course, this is the main theme of the passage. This is what really stands out. Jesus makes himself a friend of sinners, as he's accused of in Luke chapter 15. He associates with these people that are loathsome in everybody else's eyes. But I love this about Jesus. So let's think about this a little bit more and try to understand what was going on and what this party looked like at Levi's house. First of all, let's set the geography once again. Remember, Jesus is ministering in this area of Israel, and specifically, he spends a lot of time in the northern region of Galilee up there. And so that's really his home base, and although he journeys down to Jerusalem here and there, he spends a lot of time up there in Galilee. Specifically, he's on the north side of the Sea of Galilee around Capernaum. So at the beginning of this chapter, the passage that Perry took us through last week, it starts with verse 1. It says, and when he returned to Capernaum, after some days it was reported that he was at home. So again, this was his home base. He came back to Capernaum and was ministering there. Jump ahead to the beginning of this week's passage, verse 13. He went out again beside the sea. So he was in this area and he went out again on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. And all the crowd was coming to him, and he was teaching them. So lots of people were coming around him. And as he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, follow him. So as he passed by. So what's going on here? He was teaching these people in this area around Capernaum. And it seems like a reasonably large crowd was gathering around him, listening to him. It says as he passed by, the indication is actually that he was walking along the road at this point. That's often apparently what rabbis did. They would walk along the road. There was a lot of walking in this day, walking from town to town, and he'd walk along the road and probably teach his disciples that had gathered around him. And so he's walking along the road. He sees Levi, also called Matthew. And so in Matthew's gospel, when this story is recorded, he actually uses the name Matthew. Levi was probably his given name. Matthew might have been his apostolic name that Jesus gave him. Matthew means gift of God. So Levi and Matthew are the same person. But Levi is sitting here at the tax booth, probably along the side of the road. Now, if you see on our map, you'll see different delineations, different regions there with boundaries. So the outside boundary, that maroon outside boundary is the territory that was governed by Herod the Great. Now, Herod the Great died not too long after Jesus was born. After he died, his territory was divided up and governed by some of his sons and his sister. And so you see the coloring of the various regions. That were governed by different people. And so Galilee was governed by Herod Antipas, so Herod the Great's son. And you see that gray area up to the west, northwest of the Sea of Galilee. And then to the north and northeast, that was governed by Philip, his other son, one of his other sons. And oftentimes what would happen would be people would travel. They would travel down these major roads, kind of these highways, and say they might be coming from the Decapolis or from Philip's territory up north and northeast, maybe from Caesarea Philippi or Damascus further north, and they would come down and they would go through Galilee. They would enter into Herod Antipas's territory, and they may continue on all the way west to the Mediterranean. And so there's a good chance people are traveling along a road here, and there's a tax booth. It's kind of like a toll booth set up. And as they transition from one region, one jurisdiction to another, they may have to pay some sort of a toll there. I mean, that could have likely been what was going on. And so Matthew or Levi was sitting at that booth along the side of the road, probably. And you can imagine what this would be like. He's sitting there, and this crowd of people with Jesus in the middle is walking down the road. It might have been kind of intimidating for Matthew, actually. Okay, a lot of these people, and these people probably didn't like him. Most people didn't. And so they're coming, and this large crowd of people, and they come beside his booth, and then Jesus stops, and he says to Levi, follow me. Follow me. Kind of awkward here. Again, there's probably a larger crowd of people, and they stop by the despised tax collector's booth, and Jesus says to Matthew, come, follow me. Now, he's a tax collector. What were tax collectors like? How were tax collectors perceived? You know, tax collectors are spoken of a lot in the Gospels. I think there are 22 times where a tax collector or tax collectors are mentioned. So they are pretty central figures in the Gospels, and Jesus interacted with them quite a bit. Well, how were they perceived? Well, number one, they were traitors. Okay, so Matthew here was probably he was an employee of Herod Antipas, who was a servant of the Roman Empire, and the Roman occupation was actually absolutely despised. And so this was the central issue here, that the Roman oppressors were oppressing them. But Matthew or Levi was a guy who chose to work for the Roman government, and so he was betraying his countrymen. And this, of course, was despised. He was a traitor. The Roman occupation was despised, and so anybody who worked for them was absolutely despised. But not only were they traitors, they were also extortionists. They were thieves. And we see that even in Luke chapter 3, in John the Baptist's ministries. So John comes preaching, and he's preaching to lots of people, and he addresses specific groups of people. One of those specific groups he addresses is the tax collectors. Tax collectors also came to be baptized and said to him, "Teacher, what shall we do?" They were feeling convicted, and so they come to John the Baptist and say, what do we need to do to repent? And John says, "Collect no more than you are authorized to do." And he says that because they were collecting more than they were authorized to do. That was just the general pattern of a tax collector. So they were traitors, but then they took advantage of their position. They took advantage of people, and they extracted, coerced money out of people, and they became rich because of that. It was actually, for certain people, it was a sought-after job because they could get rich quick. But of course, they gave up the respect of their countrymen as they were stealing from people and taking more than they were authorized to do. Now, because of this, they, of course, were hated, and they were of the lowest moral character. You know, Jesus demonstrates that in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5. This is when Jesus is talking about loving your enemies. And he says, love your enemies, and he says, don't just love the people that love you, the people that are easy to get along with, the people that are like you. So for you, if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And so he's using the tax collectors as this example. They're the lowest bar. If the tax collectors can do that, then anybody can do that. Okay, because they have such low moral fiber. Okay, so they were the lowest moral character, and because of that, they were not to be associated with. Jesus says in Matthew 18, he's talking about addressing a sinner, somebody who has sinned against you. You go to that person and you talk about it, and if they refuse to listen to you, you take somebody else along with you, and then you take the church along with you. It says, if he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church, and if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. And so this is how tax collectors were to be treated here. In an effort to maintain the purity of the community here, of the nation, they were not to associate with, they were not to eat with Gentiles. And then those within the nation, if you were a tax collector, you were not even to associate with that person. They were absolutely despised. I wonder what this would be like in our age. Is there some sort of parallel, some sort of comparison? I think there may be a variety of different comparisons, different categories of people that may be viewed in a similar way to how tax collectors were viewed. What came to mind for me were the people that scam the elderly out of money. Okay, that's pretty despicable, obviously. But those people that they do the scam calling, and they bilk tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars out of the vulnerable. And we hear about that, or if we've had maybe a family member affected by something like that, it, you know, our blood boils. We see that as just completely despicable. Like, it's a horrible thing to do. Some of you probably watched YouTuber Mark Rober, and Mark Rober's known for his squirrel obstacle courses and his glitter bombs for porch pirates. But there's one where he actually targets the call centers of the scammers, and he sends these packages, and they infest the call centers with cockroaches and stink bombs and, you know, things like that. And then he hacks into their CCTV and records it and kind of exposes these call centers that are scamming people. And you watch it, and it's so satisfying. Because you're thinking, these guys are getting exactly what they deserve. These are the worst of the worst. Because you imagine, you know, your grandmother being scammed out of all this money, and you think, these guys deserve much worse than they're getting. And so it feels so satisfying. But I wonder, were tax collectors kind of similar in the way that they were perceived in this culture here? Were they similar? They were despicable. They were loathsome. They were to be hated, and perhaps justifiably so. And it was not something that they just fell into. It was by their own choice. You know, Jesus is known as a friend of the outcast. He associates with the outcast, but it's different when he associates with, say, a leper who is an outcast through no fault of their own. But tax collectors, they were outcasts because they made a choice. They chose to pursue this occupation in order to line their own pockets. And so they were justifiably hated. And yet, Jesus was called a friend of tax collectors, and the tax collectors came around him. And that's what we read throughout the Gospels. That's why they're mentioned so much, is that they were constantly drawing near to Jesus. And in this case, he's walking along the road with his whole entourage here, lots of people observing what he's doing, and he decides to do this horribly awkward and insulting thing, and he says, Matthew, come with me. Follow me. Not only that, but later that day, he hangs out at Matthew's house with all of his friends. So verse 15, and as he reclined at table in his house, many tax collectors and sinners were reclining with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. Or we could read Luke's version. And Levi made him a great feast in his house. There was a large company of tax collectors and others reclining at table with them, a large company of scammers, a large company of those people that were naturally loathed and detested. And these people, they didn't have other friends, and so they only had each other. And so the tax collectors and sinners, probably, you know, maybe prostitutes at other places, tax collectors and prostitutes are sort of lumped together. Those people that were rejected by everybody else due to their choices, their moral choices, they just had each other, so they probably had this little community. And so they all came together, and Jesus hung out there, and you just wonder, what would this have been like? You know, these pretty rough characters that didn't have a lot of moral integrity, and he clumped them all together, and was there a lot of coarse joking? Was there a lot of strategizing how to take advantage of people? This would have been an awkward setting. It probably would have been awkward for his other disciples. Okay, they started following Jesus, and now they find themselves in this party with all these tax collectors who they had been trained to avoid, saying, I should distance myself from these people. And so we go on and we read about the response from the Pharisees. And the Pharisees ask his disciples, why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? And that's a reasonable question. I mean, of course, we often see the Pharisees as the bad guys, and they had a lot of issues. But I might have been thinking kind of similarly here. Again, if you take those scam callers and you put them in a room, I'm not going to be real eager to just hang out and chit-chat with them, because they're so detestable. But that's where they found themselves. And so Jesus is hanging out, along with his disciples, with his large company of tax collectors. And the Pharisees justifiably ask, why is he doing this? And Jesus' response is profound. And when Jesus heard it, he said to them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. And he says, I'm going to be found here. people that need healing, not just physical healing, but they need to be healed from this disease of sin and self. That's where I'm going to plant myself. That's what Jesus is telling them. Now, he's not making two categories of people here. There are the righteous, you know, all of us, and then there are tax collectors and prostitutes and sinners. No, everybody's a sinner. But he is associating with those that are more likely to acknowledge that they are sinners. Okay, he doesn't have a lot of time for those who are not ready to acknowledge that they are sinners. So that's where he's going to be found. He's going to be found among those in most in need, not just physical need, but morally. He's going to be found amongst those who have those kinds of needs. And he doesn't just happen to get there. He initiates this. Okay, he's stepping into this context very purposefully. Okay, he was the one who initiated with Matthew. Matthew, come follow me. Matthew wasn't going to do that on his own. He wouldn't have thought he would be accepted, but Jesus initiates and said, come with me. And then he goes to this party. It also reminds me of another instance with a tax collector in Luke 19. This is the story of Zacchaeus. We're actually going to go through this story in detail later in the summer, but I'll just preview it briefly. Zacchaeus, he lived in Jericho. He was the chief tax collector. Okay, so he had become especially rich through extortion. But Jesus is walking through town, and he walks straight to where Zacchaeus was. He was up in a tree. He says, Zacchaeus, I'm coming over to your house. And he invites himself over. And then it transforms Zacchaeus. And he agrees to pay back what he had stolen. And Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, since he also is a son of Abraham, for the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. Okay, that's what Jesus came to do, to seek. Like, he's seeking the lost. He intentionally seeks out the tax collector type, initiates with them. He just doesn't fall into these kinds of situations. He's like purposefully entering into those spaces. And so what I love about Jesus is that he keeps company with the despised. It's really pretty amazing. And he still does. And he still initiates. And he still initiates with you and with me. And we're in the same category. Remember, we're in the same category with the tax collectors. We're sinners. But Jesus takes that step. He seeks. He initiates. He invites himself over. And he says, follow me. And I love that about Jesus, and we're going to come back to that. Second thing that I love about Jesus, he brings unlike people together. Now, this isn't explicit in the passage, but I thought it would be important to mention. If we're talking about Matthew this morning, we should probably mention this, that he brings unlike people together. If you watch The Chosen, this brings this out quite a bit. Brings it out that Matthew would likely not have been well received by the other disciples. And not only not well received by, say, Peter and James and John, but probably especially Simon the Zealot. Okay, Simon the Zealot would not have received him very well. Jesus, in Luke 16, records this. Jesus went out to the mountain to pray, and all night he continued in prayer to God. So he spends this night in prayer, and then he selects or designates 12 apostles. He had this large following, many, many disciples, but he's going to create an inner circle here of 12. And two of those people are Matthew, or Levi, and Simon, who is called the Zealot. Now, a zealot, of course, is somebody who especially despises the Roman occupation and is willing to do whatever it takes to overthrow that occupation and to use even violent means to do it. And so you've got Matthew, who's working for the Romans, and Simon, who wants to violently overthrow the Romans. And you just try to imagine that. Try to imagine you have the most volatile political issue of the day. And you can imagine whatever that is today. But take the most volatile political issue of the day, and then you take two people that are on complete opposite sides of the spectrum regarding that issue. And you pull them together and say, you're going to be really close the next 3 years. kind of 24/7, you guys are going to be hanging out here. And that doesn't seem wise. And I can imagine the other disciples, you know, taking, you know, it was probably Peter. Peter takes them aside and says, Jesus, let's think this through. Okay, this is probably not what we should be doing here. You know, I understand you're pretty accepting and all, but that's one thing. But it's another thing to combine these kinds of people together and create this sort of community. This is going to go very poorly. Maybe you do that sometimes. I do that sometimes, where you advise God. Okay, you offer him some counsel because you say, God, I don't think you're seeing this correctly here. And we should do things differently. This is going to go very poorly. But I find myself doing that, and then what typically happens is I eventually realize that God is smarter than me. Okay, God's smarter than me, and he knows what he's doing, and he's intentional with it. And he intentionally chose these two men and said, you're going to spend a lot of time together. And I actually love that Jesus does this. And this is my typical experience with God as well. This is my experience in the church. I believe that God often brings unlike people together and makes them partners and gives them something to do together. You know, when I first came to Christ, I was in college, and I discovered this new faith, and I discovered it alongside what I would call my best friend in college. Many of you know him. His name is Dove, and he's now a pastor at our sister church in El Paso. And again, his name is Dove, like the bird. Okay, and that's what he would often introduce himself. Say, hey, my name's Dove, and people would say Doug. He'd say, no, Dove, like the bird. And so sometimes we'd even skip the first part and just say, hey, my name is Dove, like the bird. It's like that was his middle name, like the bird. And so he'd introduce himself that way because nobody could quite get that, because that's an unusual name. I have not met anybody else named Dove, but his name was Dove. And he and his family would admit, his parents were hippies. Okay, they were like the real deal, bona fide, out of that 60s and 70s hippie movement. And so his name was Dove. His brothers, he had four brothers and a sister. Their names were similar. One of his brothers' middle name was Rainbow, and that's just how they did things. They lived on the outskirts of the town of Alamosa in southern Colorado, and kind of out in the country a little bit. They built their own house with their own hands, probably not to code, and again, that's how they operated. His dad was a fun guy. I didn't get to spend a whole lot of time around his dad, but there was just a kindness and a peace in him. He had this big, bushy, gray beard, and just had a lot of expression to him. And he would dance around the campfire, sometimes clothed, sometimes not. And that's again how he would operate. This is how their family was. I my background was different than that. And I grew up in Broomfield, Colorado, a suburb of Denver, semi-affluent suburb town there. When we got to college and we started hanging out and had other friends accuse us, this wasn't totally true, mind you, but the labels they would give, Dove was the hippie and I was the preppy. Okay, so that's just kind of the labels that they gave. I grew up in Broomfield. We weren't country club members, but we did live a half block from the country club. Our house backed up to the golf course, and actually backed up to the driving range of the golf course, and the driving range was a lake, and so you bought buckets of balls that floated, your floaters, and you hit them out into the lake, and then they would float back in eventually to the shore. And so my friends and I would often go out and collect balls that had floated into the shore because it was just in our backyard. And we'd collect these balls and then hit them out into the lake again, trying not to get caught. It was actually stealing. There's this pre-salvation for me, but we'd hit these balls back. One time, we collect all these balls and your hands are kind of wet, and I took a swing and my club just sailed. And it was a nice swing. It was like 30 yards out into the lake. And we borrowed my neighbor's canoe and a rake, and we tried to find it, but we never could. As far as I know, my 5-iron is still at the bottom of the lake there behind my house. I played tennis, okay, in high school. My parents' occupation, okay, I don't often tell people this, but my parents built nuclear weapons. And that's actually for real. For those of you that are old and have lived in Colorado for 30 plus years, you probably remember Rocky Flats. Rocky Flats was this facility that actually designed and constructed weapons of mass destruction. Okay, it was closed down in the 90s. My parents worked there. My dad worked there for quite a while. My mom eventually got a job there. And so that's what they did. That was our family business. Okay, my initial degree in college was civil engineering. And so my dad would, one of his favorite jokes was that he built the bombs and I built the targets. And that's just what he would say. So anyways, that was my background. Those were my parents. In college, Dove and I became very, very close friends. And we started to become friends even before we both came to Christ, but eventually we were both introduced to the church here. It was actually some of you, the Some of You student group. And together we opened ourselves to the gospel, to Jesus. And we came to Christ together. And on paper, we should not have been close friends, but we were extremely close friends. He was the best man in my wedding, I in his. Our hearts were just sort of knit together there, and he was an incredible gift for me. You know, when I think of incredible gifts that have been given to me, there's, of course, salvation, there's my wife, there's my kids, and there was my friendship with Dove. Because I don't know if I really would have made it. Like, to have that partner there, even though we were very, very, very different, and not only in background, but even in personality and how we thought about things, Dove had an incredible ability to connect with the outsider. You know, those that were considered kind of the misfits by everybody else, he had this incredible ability to do that. I envied it. I brought probably more of the kind of organizational leadership and could help us just kind of get some direction there, but he would fill in with this ability to welcome the outsider and the outcast like nobody I've seen, actually. And God combined us and created this sweet partnership that was, I think, pretty crucial for our own faiths and for what we did with the gospel. I think God often does that. And that has been in my experience for the past nearly 30 years with small groups. I've been in small groups for nearly 30 years, and so often God creates a small group with people that shouldn't be together. Like on paper, it's like these people shouldn't be friends. But they're brought together somehow. And God does it, I believe, intentionally. I like how he describes it in 1 Corinthians 12, talking about the body of Christ. Okay, Paul uses this metaphor. We're all parts of the body. And it says this, God arranged the members of the body, each one of them, as he chose. But God has so composed the body. It's like God, in his mysterious sovereignty, somehow brings people together and positions them as he sees fit. And makes them work together, and it's this beautiful thing. It doesn't feel beautiful at first. You think, why are we together here? This doesn't. I don't feel like I naturally click. But I believe that God melds unlike people together and gives them this common heart that's really beautiful. And maybe many of you are experiencing that right now in your small groups and you're in the church here. Where God is linking you together with other people that you may not have been natural friends with, but you see his ability to develop these friendships. I think of our pastoral team here, and there are four of us as pastors, and I think there's differences in those four. And I think these guys don't think right. You know, they're just what are they doing? None of them are sports fans. Okay, none of the other three. It's ridiculous. But he's brought the four of us together, and there's a contribution from each one of us, and I think there's a beauty there. And I believe that God does that. He composes the body, he arranges the members of the body as he sees fit, and it's a beautiful thing. I love about Jesus that he brings unlike people together. And then thirdly, I love that Jesus compels a response. So he passed by, he said to Levi, "Follow me." And how it records it is, he rose and followed him. I think there was just this immediate response, just compelled. And we don't know if he was exposed to Jesus prior to this. He may have been. He may have known at least something about Jesus. But I think in this moment, Matthew or Levi got more of a glimpse of who Jesus was. You know, as he was walking along the road, and it's an awkward situation, and Matthew knows everybody hates him here, and this is weird. He wants to run away, and Jesus says, "Matthew, follow me." And Matthew's eyes were probably opened up to who Jesus was, and says, "Jesus is willing to initiate with me. Jesus is willing to befriend me. I will give him everything." And immediately he dropped everything and he followed him. And there was no going back for Matthew. The others, you know, Peter and Andrew and James and John, they were fishermen. If this whole Jesus thing didn't work out, they could probably go back to their fishing. If this didn't work out with Matthew, he was not going to get his job back, pretty sure. Okay, he was making this huge decision. But he saw some of what Jesus was like, and he thought, this is worth it. I am throwing everything, throwing my lot in with Jesus. I want to follow this man, because he saw him. He saw who Jesus was. He loved it. He wanted to be with him. He wanted to learn from him. He wanted to imitate him. And there was going to be a cost or a potential cost. There was going to be risk. It's probably going to be awkward as he entered into this community, but he saw it as worth it. There was nothing else that was going to rival being with Jesus. Some of you may be wrestling with that right now, just considering the claims of Jesus, considering who Jesus is, and wondering about taking that step and following him. And I just want to urge you and say it's worth it. And there is a cost. And it may change things, significant things about your life, but Jesus is worth it. When you see who Jesus is, you are compelled to love him, and you are compelled to follow him and to obey him, be like him, want to be around him all the time. And it's way better than anything else. And just being with Jesus, he compels that kind of following, that kind of responsiveness. And I would urge you to take that step if you're sensing that, sensing his invitation, saying, "Come follow me." But after taking that initial step, we do follow him. We do imitate him. We become like him. That's what he's drawing us into. He wants to make us like him. And I believe that when he does that, as followers of Jesus, we will imitate him in the things that we've talked about this morning. As followers of Jesus, we will intentionally keep company with sinners. I think that's true. There are a bunch of caveats, and that can be kind of provocative, but there will be this intentionality where we will probably take certain steps into messy places. We will probably intentionally associate with the disreputable. As followers of Jesus, I think we will do that. Sort of like that famous quote from C.T. Studd. It said, "Some wish to live within the sound of a chapel bell. I wish to run a rescue mission within a yard of hell." And he was communicating something, okay, that he wanted to find himself among those who were teetering and who were within that yard. And I believe that when we're following Jesus, that wells up within us. And we say, I'm willing to enter into these spaces. Now, of course, there are caveats there. We must know our own weaknesses and limitations. You know, obviously, if I'm a recovering alcoholic, I'm not going to have a bar ministry. That would not be wise. And we have to gauge our own weaknesses and understand that we're not Jesus. Okay, Jesus could enter these situations in a better way than we could. And so we've got to be discerning, obviously, about those kinds of things. And yet, in some way, we're probably going to take a step in that direction. And we're going to consider our limitations. We're going to consider what's wise and what's not, but we will probably take a step in that direction. But as we're considering what that step may be, and I think we should, you know, I this has been an important exercise for me even this week to consider, am I intentionally stepping into those kinds of contexts? Can I purposefully do something that I'm not doing? I think we should be considering those things. But one way to help make that decision as we're considering our weaknesses and limitations is just to simply aim to do it together. You know, I think the body of Christ should enter into these kinds of places. Jesus did it himself when he was bodily here, and now we as the body and multiple parts of the body should do it together as well. Because I am limited in what I can bring myself. I'm limited in what I and how I represent Jesus. By myself, I cannot show love for others, like other believers. I kind of need another person at least to show all that Jesus is. So I think we should aim to do it together. That's just something that we should all consider. After considering Jesus' example, we should ask ourselves, is there a step that he would like me to take, and can I do it with others? Or maybe support others that are already there. That's kind of what Jesus did with Matthew. Okay, he called Matthew, and then he used Matthew's relationships to expose himself to more people. And we should consider how to do it together. And then secondly, as followers of Jesus, we will cultivate an appreciation of God's arrangement of the parts of the body. And maybe that's a struggle for you right now, where you feel like the fellowship that I'm experiencing is kind of hard, and I don't feel like I click with people, and it's just stretching me in different ways. But would God have you try to cultivate that kind of appreciation? Say, God knows what he's doing. Okay, God may have brought me together with somebody else very intentionally because he wants to display something through our relationship, through our differences. That may be true. Okay, we're gonna wrap up here, and next we're gonna start wrapping up with our kids' question. Okay, so we're gonna move to the kids' question. Remember, this is for 7 to 12-year-olds. So if you're 16, you can't answer. And you're gonna read an action Bible, and the idea is it's just the first one to raise your hand that I see. And I'm going to call on you, and then you're going to answer the question that I'm going to put up here on the screen. And again, I kind of told you what the question's going to be, and your answer could be straight from this morning, or it could be something else that we didn't cover this morning, but that you have experienced recently. And so I'm going to look for a hand that shoots up, and then Chad here is going to take the mic to you, and you're going to just say your name and your age and answer the question. Okay, and so here is the question. What do you love about Jesus? How about right down here to the left?
So say your name, age, and then answer it.
My name is Anna Lee, and I'm 8 years old. And I love that Jesus is perfect, and that he never sinned, and that he's just a reflection of God.
Beautiful. That's great. All right. I got Action Bible for you. Yeah. All right, and we're going to do something a little extra too. So she won the big prize, but I've got more candy up here too. So some little prizes. And I want to keep asking that question. And I'm going to have, I'm just going to, you can just pop your hand up there, and Chad will take the mic to you. And I want to hear a few responses to what do you love about Jesus. Again, it could be from this morning, or it could be just something else that you've considered. This is the answer, the question that we want to answer really every week. What do we love about Jesus? So Chad is going to, you know, we both played tennis, actually. And so I thought I should like send him back and forth across the auditorium like on a tennis court. No, we'll work our way across, starting over to the left, and we'll have a few answers here. So Chad, I thought I saw, oh, yeah, I think there's a hand
here?
Right over there. What do you love about Jesus?
My name is Eliana, and I am 10, and what I love about Jesus is that he loves everybody, even if they're not perfect. And since he's perfect, he will help us get to know God better.
Fantastic. All right. I'm going to throw some candy here. All right. Let's see if we can kind of work our way across the auditorium. We'll take a few more. How about Galilee there?
My name is Galilee, and I love about Jesus is that he always forgives us.
There we go. Here, heads up. Oh,
short.
That one needs something with a little more density there. All right, let's keep going. We'll do a few more. Maybe back, yeah, with the nickels there.
Okay, Lydia, say your name and your age.
My name is Lydia, and I'm 7 years old, and what I love about Jesus is that he answers prayers.
Okay, here we go. Oh! All right, maybe if there's any more around here, how about we go over back here? Is that Timothy, I think, yeah.
I'm Timothy, and I'm 10, and I love that he helps us.
There we go.
It does help us.
All right, let me grab that. Anybody else over here? Oh, how about down here in front?
Got two?
Sure, we'll do this too.
My name is Maya, and I'm 9. What I love about Jesus is that he loves us no matter what we do, and he listens to us always and is with us always.
That's great, yeah.
Hello. Hello, I'm Inara, and I'm 7, and what I like about Jesus is he notices sad people, and he helps them get happy.
There you go. That's great. Okay. Nice job, guys. Again, we want to get good at answering that question. So, band, you can go ahead and come on back up. I said that earlier. But I hope that all summer, as we go through this Encounter Jesus series, we can just come away each Sunday saying, oh, man, you know what? I love that about Jesus. Love that he's like that. You know, summarize this morning, Jesus intentionally befriends people that others avoid. That's one thing I love about him. And I hope that we can see that a little more clearly. We can consider the different communities, environments that we're involved with, and we can consider those that others tend to avoid and understand that Jesus would beeline towards those people. And he intentionally befriends those that we would naturally avoid. And that's what I love about him.